You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton. Tristan Carcino is off today because I am in Las Vegas, joined by someone we have wanted to get on the podcast for a very long time. My colleague at ESPN, our NFL writer extraordinaire, Bill Barnwell. This is a long overdue Pelton Cast. One I thought would never happen.
That's not true.
I know I did it. I did think that it would never happen. You know why? Because you said it wouldn't happen.
That doesn't mean, just because I say something doesn't mean that it's actually going to be true. I don't know if you've seen my predictions about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in recent years.
Actually, yes, because I was going back through all of our old tweets to each other.
Oh, no.
And man, let me tell you, there were a lot of bad puns in there. There were a lot of, no, let me admit that. There were a lot of great puns in there. Because you said in May 2017, after we had Sue Bird on the Pelton Cast, I don't make guest appearances unless I'm the biggest star, and it's too late for that now.
Is that not accurate? Am I not? I am not as big of a star as the guest you had last week.
Jamal Crawford.
Let alone Sue Bird, who proved last week that not only is she better at her job than me, she's better at my job than me.
I mean, seriously, like, Sue, leave something for the rest of us.
Leave
for God's sake.
A little bit of meat on the bone for us, Sue.
I mean, we can't play point guard.
Can't play point guard. Can't date Megan Rapinoe.
Nope.
Cannot write and make people cry the way that Sue Bird's article made me cry. So an absolute disaster for me. This whole incredibly successful, fun U.S. national team has really destroyed me internally over the past few weeks.
So then a follow-up. Yes. There was a flicker of hope last fall.
Oh, was there?
Last November, after the Aaron Rodgers loss, the Packers loss on Monday Night Football in Seattle against the Seahawks, Packers fans melted down over you saying that Aaron Rodgers was not to blame for missing that third down pass late in the game.
Sure.
And we read all of the replies to you
on
the air on our post-game Pelton Cast. And you said, I will come on, but only to read my mention. So a long history here.
Yes.
Last night, while we were at dinner, I believe you described yourself not as a friend of the Pelton Cast, but an enemy of the Pelton Cast.
But you know what they say. Keep your friends close. Keep your enemies closer to your podcast.
Yeah, that's a famous slate.
That is the famous Sun Tzu quote.
So when you agreed to do this podcast, when you were in Seattle a few weeks ago, you also laid out a ground rule.
I did.
Which is that I was allowed three football questions.
That's correct.
One of them can be about the Seahawks.
One of them can be directly about the Seattle Seahawks.
One of them can involve the Seahawks, about the greater league.
Yes, like a broad NFL question, but I'm going to certainly consider the Seahawks in the context of that question.
And one of them not about the Seahawks at all.
One of them, if you ask me a question and there's incredible amounts of Seahawks content, I will set it aside and only talk about the non-Seahawks element of
That's fair. I've carefully, with Tristan's help, he's advised. See, I hoped that we could have done this, all three of us, in person. But you guys are ships passing in the night. You're flying out Thursday morning. He's flying in Thursday morning.
I don't want to say this. I feel like this is maybe a little too real for the Pelton Cast, but I feel like Tristan is maybe a little afraid of me and intimidated by me. And I would sure respond, I'm also a little intimidated and afraid of Tristan. So,
well, someday we're going to have to make that meeting happen. I was going to say meeting of the minds. I'm not sure that's an accurate description of that.
Yes, so three NFL questions.
So we're going to save those for the end.
You want to say, okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, we're going to make people sit through our Las Vegas food talk.
20 minutes of stuff they don't care.
To the Seahawks content they crave.
That's beautiful. Perfect.
The 1.5 questions of Seahawks content they crave.
Yes.
You are a former resident of Las Vegas.
It's true. I lived here for a year. I believe it was 2011. That was my initial pitch to...
It was like fall of 2011 to the following summer 2012.
Yes, that was August 2011, August 2012. That was my initial pitch to... Bill Simmons, when the Grantland website started, I was approached actually at the Sloan Conference, where we see each other every year pretty much. And he said, hey, what would you write about if you could write about anything and get paid for it? And I was 27. I thought to myself, well, what would a 27-year-old Bill Simmons say to this question? And he would say, I would go live in Vegas for a year. So that was my pitch. And it worked.
And now you write exclusively about living in Vegas. It worked out perfectly.
It has been wildly successful for me, the strategy of living in Vegas.
So that was the first time that we hung out in Vegas, because yes. I came down for Summer League in 2012. You yes. taught me how to play craps.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And we won a lot the first time, which is a very dangerous thing to happen the first time
really
you play craps.
Is. I also taught my partner recently to do this as well. And that in exactly the same way. Very successful the first time. Extremely unsuccessful afterwards.
I don't think I've won money any other time I've played craps. Like, there's sometimes I haven't lost all of it. And then it's a great experience as long as you can just ride it out for a yes. long period of time.
Where do we play? Do you remember?
Palms.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I don't think I've played.
One of the tweets I pulled up was... me saying to you and the other person who was with us, who shall remain nameless,
I think I remember this now.
We'll always have the palms.
We'll always have the palms.
And you replied, the Maloof said the same thing.
Now I'm just laughing at my own jokes.
It's okay if there's like 7 years in between.
Yes. Was there also I think there was a Daniel Kahneman quote involved with this craps playing experience, if I'm not mistaken?
I don't think so. That must have been something subsequent, because I don't even think I knew who Danny Kahneman was at that point.
Oh, really? Okay. Maybe it was subsequent. Anyway.
You got lost repeatedly driving around Las Vegas.
Yes.
But where you lived. But most Fair. Importantly, we shared several meals together for the first time in Vegas.
We did.
How would you describe the food scene in Las Vegas when you lived here? Because it seems to me it's changed pretty dramatically in the past 7 years.
Really? Interesting.
You don't think so?
I think to some extent. Like, certainly there is a... The attrition rate for restaurants is very high here.
Yes.
I think it's absolutely fair to say. But I think there is, it reminds me a little bit of New York in a strange way, where I think there is that element of, oh, if something is successful elsewhere, it comes to New York and yes. it comes to Las Vegas, which is a blessing and a curse. There is, for example, Tafara Pizza, one of the most famous pizza places in New York City. It's a highly regarded restaurant run by a very old man who operates on his own schedule and just chops off huge pieces of basil, puts it on the pizza, and it's regarded as a real sort of, like pilgrimage. If you're a big pizza person in New York, which, as you know from my Instagram, that fits me. They opened like two Tafara-related branches here. So New York and Las Vegas. And the pizza they have here is kind of bad. Like, there's one in Caesars, yes. It is bad. And then the Defar, there's like a Dom DeMarco's, is the name of the guy. It's also the name of the place. I think his son opened it in like Henderson. And it's bad. But you're like, well, I have to try this because it's the novelty of having a Defar pizza here is incredible to me. So I think there is this weird element of like these sort of offshoots of places. Like, there's the Pock Pock, for example. There's
we're going to talk about that in a second.
A Pock Pock wing here. And I think that's strange, and there's a lot of like novelty things to try. And then there's this sort of weird dichotomy I noticed from living here, especially when I had people come visit, because a lot of weekends I would have friends come visit. And there is this sort of strange balance that there's either incredibly expensive places to eat or extremely cheap places to eat.
Yes.
And there is nothing in between besides chain restaurants.
Yes, I think that's accurate. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing, because of what you said, is like, this is the place where you can compare chains from different regions of the country.
Absolutely. This is maybe outside of Florida, which I feel like Florida is perhaps the epicenter of the chain restaurant universe.
That sounds
I mean,
right.
like I can, as an example, I grew up in Queens, in New York City, and there was at the Queens Center Mall, there was a Arthur Treacher's fish and chips in the food court. And I had never seen one since. And I was like, wow, you know, small chain. Like, I figure it must not be many of them. Here, there is a standalone Arthur Treacher's with a drive-thru. And I had not seen one anywhere else in the United States. It's just like there is this incredible swath of food from around the country that I think I didn't appreciate until I moved here.
What I would say has changed here in the last 7 years is... Number one, there, you know, I mean, everywhere in the country, there's a greater appreciation of food
yes.
and like people thinking harder about the decisions
For
they
sure.
make about food,
yes.
inspired by Yelp, inspired by people being more just like our generation of people more or less being more interested in that.
Yes.
So, you know, I think one of the dramatic changes, you mentioned the Pock Pock wing.
Mm-hmm.
Cosmopolitan has like, I think it's the foodie hotel, I guess
yes,
you would say,
100%.
Is a shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
Or in casino, of course. They have Momofuku.
Yes.
They have Julian Serrano's restaurant, right?
Yes. They have a Jose Andres, Andres restaurant. Yeah. They have a secret pizza place.
Which is not secret at all.
Not secret in the slightest. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's that, like, that for a place that, you know, wanted to market to a certain type of young person, I think that is enough to be a niche, whereas I think 30 years, you know, 20 years ago, that would not have been the case.
No. I mean, and I think the Block 16 concept that they have mm-hmm. is an interesting example of this, because, you know, there's lots of places here that have food courts, and you've got, again, the chain restaurants. It's not so dissimilar from what you'd find in the mall at home or in an airport.
Yes.
Even though both of those things are probably evolving to some extent as well.
Yes.
But Cosmopolitan built a food court that is like exclusively trendy restaurants from elsewhere in the country, which is a fascinating concept.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is this SponCon for the Cosmopolitan?
It is not.
And you didn't tell me?
It is not. I'm actually going to like list some negatives of Block 16 later in this podcast in a moment here.
But absolutely.
It's an amazing concept.
Yes. And I think there was something really cool about that, in that, you know, realistically, like, I lived in New York. I lived a short walk, not a short walk, like a 15-minute walk from a Pock Pock, like a real Pock Pock that closed, and I was very sad. And the idea that I can come to Vegas and get that is fascinating to me. And, you know, I do think 20 years ago, if the Cosmopolitan said, hey, we're going to open a food court, it would have been, you know, maybe a Chick-fil-A on the fancier, I guess, more well-known side. Like, there probably would have been a Nathan's, because every other food court in Vegas has a Nathan's.
Roll of sandwiches, maybe?
An Earl of Sandwiches. Maybe if they wanted to get really aggressive, maybe a Sarku Japan. And that's fine. Like, I am not trying to disparage those places. Like, they are good for what they are. And but I think having a Pock Pock and having a Hattie B's and having... what else is there?
District Donuts.
District Donuts. Like just the variety of things, I think, that... This idea of, okay, well, like, this is something that is cool in this part of the country or in this state. Let's bring this here. Like, I think there is something exciting about that.
Yeah. I mean, one of my rules of thumb when I travel mm-hmm. is that I never want to go to any place I can go in Seattle. I make one exception for that, which is Shake Shack, because of the fact that it's actually so difficult to get to in Seattle. As we have discussed on a previous podcast, it's easier to go to Las Vegas.
To be clear, you and I have not discussed that.
No, that was a previous Pelton cast with mom.
Do you like where do you put Shake Shack in your pantheon of like hamburgers?
Well, this is a great question mm-hmm. because within the past week, as we mentioned, confluence of chains.
Yes.
I have had both In-N-Out and Shake Shack, which are my top two.
Top two chain burgers.
Yes.
Okay.
And Shake Shack won.
Really?
I think I may have already like made this shocking declaration last year on the podcast after coming to Vegas, but if I didn't then, I am now.
You are now.
Shake Shack won that competition.
I like Shake Shack. I think it's good. When I lived in New York,
our mom, when she came on, said she thought it was bad.
No.
Actively bad.
Did you disown your mom? I find that the non-burger fry stuff at Shake Shack is not very good to me. Like the chicken sandwich, I think is okay.
Yeah.
When I lived in Manhattan, I lived near the Test Kitchen.
I've never ordered the chicken sandwich. I have a friend who swears by it. Who's a huge chicken sandwich fan.
I'm a big chicken sandwich person myself. It is, again, not bad. Like, I never, when I walk past that Test Kitchen to go to Trader Joe's, I would never be like, oh, I gotta go in and get that sandwich. They had nuggets. The nuggets were actually, they were pretty bad. And I was very, unfortunately.
Yeah, I tried the nuggets in Boston.
Yeah.
They were fine.
I was expecting better, but the burger is great. Have you inserted Five Guys into this discussion?
Not a Five Guys fan.
What do you not like about Five Guys?
So first off, I think a lot of the value of Five Guys to most people is the ability to get any kind of topping you want.
Sure.
The Subway of burgers in that regard.
That's a very... I'm trying to think if Subway sponsors anything we do anymore. Because there was about a three-year period where at Grantland where I would just have to be very nice about Subway. I don't want to disparage the fine people of Subway, but I think that is perhaps a harsh comparison.
It is. But in terms of like the variety of toppings, and that doesn't do almost anything for me. I want a pretty plain burger.
What do you have in your burger?
Burger sauce.
You have burger sauce. Nothing else?
Cheeseburger sauce. I mean, if you're going to like lettuce, get, the lettuce. You
I
know.
Only get ketchup on my burger. Nothing else.
Okay.
Interesting. I think there is a consistency to Five Guys that I like. There is a texture that I'm into. I think they have the best fries of the chains we are discussing here.
That is probably true.
They also,
although I like the cheese, I do like the cheese fries at
I'm not a cheese person. You know this,
I do know that actually. Okay. Yeah, that was from Safe Space. This is not a safe space. You're going to be attacked for this opinion.
That's awful. I don't know. I mean, like, I think there is a. I think Five Guys is trying to kill us with the amount of fries they are giving us in their portion sizes.
That is absolutely accurate.
I honestly think, I don't think I could eat a large fries from Five Guys if I was offered the opportunity to for money.
That's the worst episode of Man vs. Food ever.
It really is. Just one big brown bag of fries, two hands full. But yeah, I think, you know, I like Shake Shack, but I've never, I think there's rarely a time where I'm like, I have to go out of my way to get Shake Shack.
Okay. What do you think about In-N-Out?
I think the novelty of In-N-Out is what's exciting. Like, when I lived in San Francisco, the first thing I did was I landed. I was living in a hostel because I had no money, and the job I had was paying me not enough money to live in San Francisco. So I was living in a hostel until I found an apartment.
Even at that time, not enough money to pay into living in.
Yes. Oh, and it's a lot worse now.
Yeah.
And so I took the, like, I landed, I went to the hostel, dropped off my stuff, and then I took the cable car to Fisherman's Wharf and got in and out. And it was like, wow, this is California. This is great. And then I did that every single day. I lived there for the rest of the entire year. No, but like, you know, I think there was this novelty of, oh, I lived on the East Coast my whole life. Now I'm going to California and this is what people do here. I think beyond that, like, it's, I think the burgers are good, but truly abominable fries.
I have stopped getting the fries entirely on the advice of my nutritionist, Ben Baldwin, who also advises the two burgers. I haven't really gone that route yet. The two double doubles.
Yes. He also has been eating San Diego burritos based on his Twitter.
And then everything they have to offer in Japan over the past week. It's been interesting to watch and eat vicariously through him.
Yes.
How do you feel about strip versus off strip in terms of Vegas eating?
Well, so when I lived here, I lived on the strip. I lived in the city center area of Vegas. We're recording this right now.
I was going to maybe throw in Zach Lowe style, in undisclosed location in a Las Vegas hotel.
Okay, so we are recording. City center is a few different hotels.
No, that's fine. You're fine.
We can be vague within that, that context. And so, like I said, I was, you know, my first year at Grantland, I was doing okay. I think there was this misconception that Grantland, like, paid my expenses when I lived here. You know, like, paid rent or paid for me to gamble, and they did neither of those things. I was paying for that out of my own pocket. So there was a weird sort of dichotomy where, like, I would have friends come visit, and, you know, they would want to do what you do in Las Vegas. They'd want to go out, get a fancy dinner, maybe go get some drinks, maybe go gamble, and I had to pay rent.
Yeah.
Like, I had to live I had to pay college loans. I had to do these sort of, like, life things you do when you...
You also had to do that. That was their one weekend a year where they went to Vegas. Yes. Or maybe one of two.
Exactly.
It was every weekend
for you. That was every weekend. So, very quickly, I realized I can't afford to eat on the strip constantly. So, a lot of what I did was eventually go off strip. And, like, you know, I would say every day during lunch, I would go off strip. Like, I very rarely would eat a lunch on the strip. And then, you know, dinner very infrequently, I would say. By the time, I think in the first month, maybe I ate it more frequently, but then I actually started budgeting for my my first year there and realized that was not going to make any sense. So a lot of finding places off the strip, a lot of cheap chain restaurants, a lot of Chipotle, if I'm being honest with you. I think you get pretty good at finding the cheap meals here that are actually pretty competent.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Asian food in particular, you go off strip, yes, you can find incredible quality at reasonable prices.
Oh, absolutely. And I think even once you get to the locals' casinos, there are places that are very bad at locals' casinos, but there are actually pretty decent places at, you know, the station casinos here that are competent. But Asian food, I think, is definitely in high supply, and I think Mexican food as well.
Yeah.
Just because it's so close to LA, and you get the LA offshoot places.
What are the places at this point that when you go to Vegas, you're like, I want to get there while I'm in town?
Okay, that's a good question. So there's a place called Asian Barbecue and Noodle. I think I heard about this in my final Grantland piece about living in Vegas. That is, I have now been there probably a dozen times. I think I only went two or three times. I only even discovered it, like, towards the end of my time here. I think I've been there a dozen times. I have never seen another white person in there, which is a good basis for looking at food. It's just like a barbecue place, but it's just phenomenal. It's so consistently great. I'm I've been to other barbecue places. I've been to Hong Kong. I've been to you know, places that serve Cantonese barbecue. Nothing comes close to this place, which is kind of shocking. Like, it shouldn't be that much better than other places. I think it's just a lot of salt maybe is included, but it's just absolutely phenomenal. That place is incredible. That's off the strip. I'm trying to think. That is like the one place that immediately comes to mind for me. There is a 24-hour Buffalo Wild Wings by the airport, which I find the novelty of, I find extremely entertaining.
So, well, that is not the answer I was expecting.
So, because if you have video poker in your establishment, there are certain places that have video poker where you have to stay open for 24 hours, I think by law. And so this Buffalo Wild Wings has to stay open.
Buffalo Wild Wings at 4 a.m. seems like a very depressing place.
Buffalo Wild Wings at 6 a.m. does not seem ideal. I am a big Lotus of Siam fan.
Yes.
As many others are. Actually,
That's one of the unofficial spots, I would say, yes, of NBA Summer League media.
My unnamed roommate for this trip does not like Lotus of Siam.
Interesting.
We went together, and they were not especially impressed.
I like it because it has cow soy on the menu. I'm
really
big on, you know, from Bok Bok, Northern Thai, yes, food.
Yes.
And cow soy.
It does have a variety of Thai food, which is right, nice. But I have not been to the new one. I know the old one had a fire, I think.
Oh, is that why they moved? I didn't think it was where it was because I drove by it a couple of times this week.
But nothing but great things to say about Lotus of Siam. I'm trying to think of what my other go-tos are. Some of them, there is a coffee shop, like a 24-hour restaurant in the Main Street station that is like, it's like a brewery, basically. It's strangely really good. Everything I've had there has been good. I don't know how or why. I'm not downtown that frequently, but when I do, I go there. And I assume I'm a big Hattie B's fan, so I assume I will make that a go-to if it is up to the standard of the Nashville and Atlanta locations.
Well, that is a point to go back to your earlier comment about places that come here and the quality is compromised, that it's a risk you're taking. And I gotta say, so I went to the Bok Bok Wing in Block 16 the other day.
Oh no.
It was a pale imitation.
No!
The actual Bok Bok Wing.
What was wrong?
The wings were really small. They weren't as well sauced. I mean, they were still good wings. Don't get me wrong. Like, they were well worth ordering. Mm-hmm. The person I went with, Danny LaRue, had never been to Pok Pok. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, these are great.
Sure.
And I was like, you don't even know what you're missing out on.
It's always great.
I had to be that guy.
That's always great when someone is happy about something. You have to be like, no, you're wrong and you're an idiot. but I believe it.
They also have Lardo, another Portland,
yes,
a sandwich chain, and that was not a pale imitation. That was quite good.
Really,
I had Lardo yesterday.
I have not had Lardo before.
Yeah, you may have to try that.
I am, my Pacific Northwest sandwich chain is, I can't think of the name of it. And
Bonk?
No, Doug is going to be very upset with me
because it's in Vancouver.
Yeah, bread and
something. Oh yeah, bread and cheese.
Not bread and cheese. Well, you know I wouldn't go to bread and cheese.
Well, that's right.
I would pick it outside.
Bread and meat.
It's like something like bread and meat.
Yeah, there's a look. I've been to it in Vancouver. There's a location
and there's
in
one
South
in Seattle.
Lake Union. Yeah, but I've never been to the one in Seattle.
It is one of the best sandwiches I've had in my life. I went there on my birthday last year, and it was the best part of my birthday. It was exquisite. I don't remember the name of it, though. It's bread and something. Meat and bread.
Meat and bread. There we go.
That makes more sense. Yeah. That's a much better name. You get the meat out there first. Then you,
yeah, that's the highlight
meat,
of it.
Meat, okay, I'm in. Oh, bread, even better. This is great. But bread could be anything.
We may have to review that as part of our search for Seattle's best sandwich. I had not thought to include that in the list.
But to your point, I don't know that the Seattle version
is good, yeah.
Is of similar quality to the Vancouver one, which was phenomenal. So good. I think I had porchetta.
That's what I had at Lardo yesterday.
Yes. Oh, well, do you think Lardo possibly is trying to siphon off some of the meat and bread business?
Probably not.
Probably not.
It's probably a coincidence.
And I think you can even make the argument that Hattie B's in itself is a pale imitation of Prince's.
Yes.
Which, of course, is the more famous hot chicken from Memphis. I mean, I've been to both. I learned an important lesson when I went with my friends, and the first day we went to Hattie B's, and I don't think they were aware of what hot chicken was. I was aware, but had not had it before. So I think we got the medium, and it was, you know, it was not hot. Like, it was, there was spice to it, but it was good. We went to Prince's. And we're like, oh, well, that wasn't that bad. Let's get the hot princes. We learned our lesson that this was gentrified hot chicken at Hattie B's. And so the hot at Prince's was several degrees hotter than the medium at Hattie B's. And it was great, but it was, let's just say we learned our lesson.
It was a 24-hour experience.
It was a 24-hour
experience. That's how Danny Chow described it in his yes. Nashville hot chicken face.
Yes, exactly. That is a great way to describe it. But no, I am very fond of it. And I have found it to be... I like Hattie B's. I think it is consistently very good. The one I went to in Atlanta during Super Bowl week, I wrote a 10,000-word preview and then went to Hattie B's and ate the meal of a man who has written too many words. But I don't think that other places that I have tried to serve it, like in New York, for example, I found to be very mediocre.
That have tried to serve Nashville hot chicken in general or offshoots of the chains in particular?
Offshoots of Nashville hot chicken.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's here. It's a tough one.
It's a tough one. There is a food truck in D.C. that does a really good job. And I can't think of it. Rooming Roosters, maybe? I follow it on Twitter. So if you look at my Twitter followers, it's like, you know, football person, hot chicken truck, football person, basketball person.
Yeah.
So I would recommend that if you happen to live in one of three places in D.C. where it's served.
All right, it's time.
It's time already?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to keep you too long. You're a busy man.
This is the quietest time of the year for me.
It is. Someone was saying, because of the fact that you're here for Summer League, as you have been occasionally in the past, including when you lived here, that, like, you should just become a football writer. And I was like, if Bunnell were a football writer, he couldn't come into Vegas and just hang out here. He'd have to be working.
You mean a basketball writer?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Here's the thing about basketball writers. There's a lot of you.
Accurate.
And you're good.
Yeah.
The median basketball writer who's writing, you know, for a national website is infinitely better than the median football writer.
Not just
the
subtweeting tier. All of football
there media. Are certainly good football writers. I there are people who are way better than me. I think of our friend Shil Kapadia as someone who, if he wanted to write about basketball, would be great at that. If he wanted to write about hockey, would be great at that. Whatever you wanted to write about would be great at. I think Zach is very similar. I think you're very similar, where if you wanted to write about football on a regular basis, you guys could do that and be very good at that.
Sometimes, like, man, there's so many studies out there that no one is doing, but there actually are more of them. We'll get to that in a second.
Yes, but I think there is a, you know, I think just the, and we talked about this before, I think, off the air, because I would never do the show before this. But I think just the,
you know, previous conversations, which were just unrecorded podcasts.
Well, I mean, you have been on my show. The
that is true.
Bill Barnwell. I was going to say award winning, but actually not. We have not won any awards. Bill Barnwell show. But
should I make up an award and give it to you?
Lovely. That would be lovely. Best Bill Barnwell podcast. I think there would be a. I think
weirdly the Minikheim show featuring Letty won that one.
Oh, no, that's so mean.
That's harsh.
So mean. Doesn't even respond to my texts anymore. If I'm like, hey, you wanted to be on the show? She's like, oh, sorry. I'm on television for the next week straight, nonstop. Sorry. Can't blame her.
Still makes time for the Pelton cast.
Still makes time for the Pelton cast. I just think there is a, you know, whether it's steel sharpens steel, whether it's just a level of... people coming into that community from places that really did a good job of developing writers. I don't know what it is, but there is just the quality of basketball writing, I think, is so much higher than the quality of football writing. And I'm lucky, you know, I came through Football Outsider, I think is a great sort of place to start working on my career, and has developed a lot of other great writers. But I just think there is... The level of discourse and the level of fun about the discourse is so much lower in football than it is in basketball.
Yeah. So let's talk about football.
Let's talk about football.
On that note.
Yes.
All right. Question one.
Okay.
So we saw a few weeks ago the Baltimore Ravens hire multiple people from the public sphere to join their analytics department, including our friend Sean Clement, a.k.a. Sean from CBAC.
Yes.
It's part of Seahawks Twitter. Do you think this could be the start of an analytics moment for the NFL along the lines of what we've seen with people, you know, making a name for themselves on the internet and then going to work for teams in obviously first baseball, basketball, pretty not that much farther behind after the publication of Moneyball. And then more recently, hockey is definitely seeing this, where a bunch of people have gotten famous on the internet and gone to work for teams.
Mm-hmm. The short answer is mostly no.
Okay.
The long answer is I think it's complicated. I think there is a there is a interest in the NFL with staying ahead of the curve. And there is an interest with trying to find information that is useful. I don't think NFL teams are incentivized in the same way to be creative and actually rely on using data as, for example, baseball or basketball, where with baseball, at the turn of the century, if you did not have the financial clout to be with the Yankees, you had to do something different, or you were just not going to have the talent to win. In basketball, and I think maybe this is me being a little too simplistic, but if you don't have, you know, that core, that big three, or I guess now maybe big two, but like if you don't have the absolute transcendent players, you have to come up with something to try and compete in a different way or maximize the opportunities you have. And getting one of those players, I think, is sort of the, like you build your organization on the hope of getting a Kawhi Leonard or Paul right. George or a Kyrie Irving or a
I mean, James Harden might be the best example of this, where exactly. you could trace, like Sam Hinkie, when he was interviewing in Philadelphia, had the right. flow chart of all the transactions yes. it took to get the pieces they traded for James Harden.
Exactly. And I think in the NFL, owners make plenty of money without having to do anything different. Coaches who are not inclined to do something different, I think they can they think they can compete doing what they do. We're not seeing the sort of things you'd want to hear from teams who are not doing well, like the Lions, for example, I'm thinking of, where they're thinking, okay, we got to get back to basics and run the football. And it's just like, no, you're in a division where you're the worst team.
I can't think of any team that has done things like that, said things like that. No, that sure. doesn't ring a bell at all.
Sure. And you have like the Detroit Lions and the Minnesota Vikings, and some would say the Seattle Seahawks, who are paying their quarterbacks more than just about anybody else in football and want to run the ball more. Which does not seem to make a lot of sense. I just think you don't have teams who are really incentivized to use data in a way that is meaningful. And I think you have teams who want to hire people. And I think the Ravens are actually an exception to this. I think Eric DaCosta, their GM, is very analytics friendly and someone who will actually give them a meaningful voice in the room.
Which is so important as part of this.
It's the biggest thing. And I think when fans think about analytics, they really underestimate just the reality of there are a lot of teams who have someone who, you know, their job is to look at fourth down decisions and tell their coaches when to call timeouts. Getting a coach to listen is a different thing. Getting a GM to listen is a different thing. And quite often you will hear executives talk about analytics and talk about the value of analytics. But when you actually see their decisions, you know, they're not using analytics. So from that perspective, I don't think that's happening right now. I think in Baltimore it's happening, and that's great for Baltimore. And I think there are teams like...
Or Ravens.
The Ravens. Indianapolis is one of the teams where I think they're using data. And there's other teams who are using, maybe a half dozen. But until there is a team that really exploits the player tracking data and dares everyone else to catch up, I don't think there is going to be a real boom. And even when that happens, I think there are going to be a lot of teams who hire someone who is not qualified to work with the data and then gets disappointed when they don't find meaningful things off of it, and then sort of just throws their hands up and says, okay, well, we gave it a shot.
Am I allowed to follow up on that?
Yeah, sure.
Number one, I was disappointed that the Eagles winning the Super Bowl with like a bunch of aggressive fourth down decisions, like I thought that might be the moment.
You know what's funny about that? Not only did other teams not follow the Eagles,
the Eagles
didn't even follow the Eagles. Chuck Capadia was writing about this in November and December last year. Like, Doug Peterson, you just won the Super Bowl doing this. Why being conservative now? I thought when the Ron Rivera thing happened,
not only was he
doing well, but he was getting individual credit for it.
Yes.
Like it was his idea to start going forward and forth down, suddenly like, switch flip. Like I've now studied the data myself and this is what I think we should do. You know, when coaches didn't respond to that, I'd be like, okay, well, you know, if my team's struggling, I should do that too. I think that was a sign that it's going to be tough to see it actually happen. I think someone's going to have to be so aggressive to really make it stand out. Like, I think there was when Patrick Waugh was the head coach of the Avalanche, I want to say. I believe it was him, and I could be totally wrong, and there's probably hockey people yelling at me right now, but I think he started pulling his goalie much earlier than it had been in the past, where I think it had been like the final minute or so, and then it became the final maybe 3 minutes. And teams started to, I think, emulate that. And I think you have to have someone who is so extreme to make you sort of think about using that data more frequently. I think it was sort of like, I think about this a lot when it comes to the Rockies. Like, I think park effects would have been harder to get across to the non-fan without the Rockies.
Right.
Because the Rockies made it so clear that you have to account for this stuff.
Makes sense. Let's see, what was the second thought there? Oh, if a team was exploiting the player tracking data in that way, would the rest of the league know?
I think eventually they would know, because you'd have people get hired from that organization.
That makes
sense. I think the organizations who are likely to use that are also the organizations who are likely to succeed, because they're pretty smart and they know who to hire. I think there are NFL teams who are getting that data now who think, oh, it'd be great to work with this, and they want to hire someone out of college on an intern salary to work on it, not realizing that the people that need to work on it make a lot of money and are developers who are they're competing with outside of the football space.
Yes. All right, question number two.
Okay.
You grade all the signings and the trades during the NFL offseason.
And you know where I got that from.
I was going to say, I have no idea where that could have possibly come from.
There are several things that we use from the Kevin Pelton playbook. We use the grades.
First off, that's not the Kevin Pelton playbook. That's the John Hollinger playbook, and it's really my editor's playbook.
I don't know who that is. he's the guy. He disappeared into the void.
He did.
Do we acknowledge Portland Timbers fans on this podcast?
That's a great question. We probably shouldn't.
We should not. No, for sure. And certainly, you know, there are people who did grades before Hollinger as well, but I think he was a very aggressive grader, and you did it as well. And I thought it made sense to do it for a free agency. And I think the perfect 53-man roster piece we do every year is based on a template for something you did.
Oh, I didn't know that. Because I liked that idea and thought about stealing it, but we never got around to doing it.
I think we stole it. It was not the same sort of idea, but it was the template. Same
gotcha.
Same sort of template.
Okay, so... But I have not, I don't believe you've graded off seasons as a whole. Is that accurate?
No, we have someone else do that.
What grade would you give the Seattle Seahawks 2019 off season?
That's a good question. What would you give the Seattle Seahawks off season as a grade?
So this is interesting, because I was before this podcast talking to Tristan, and he said it was an A+ off season.
Oh, really?
And I was like, wow, you are an easy
shocker.
Grader. You have a lot to learn about grading off seasons, good sir. I said it was somewhere in the B range, probably a B+. I mean, now I think there's two things you have to weigh here,
sure.
Which is the short term and the long term.
Yes.
In the long term, I think the Seahawks have done amazingly with the draft picks they acquired in the Frank Clark trade.
Sure.
The number of comp picks they've picked up for the 2020 draft.
Sure.
Feeling very good about all that.
Sure.
In the short term, they lost Frank Clark and Earl Thomas.
That's the thing, is I think you have to judge it from the perspective of, are you considering that they lost Earl, like, because we knew a year ago
right.
he wasn't re-signing. And we especially knew as he was slipping off Pete Carroll. I think in if you're a Seahawks fan, in your head, you're thinking, okay, well, that's it. Like, we know he's gone.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like you don't account for that when you're thinking about the offseason, because you already wrote him off months ago. I think losing a Hall of Fame player who's still extremely good, now has some injury issues, but still extremely good, in not the prime of his career, but certainly a player who, when you look at the numbers, has been responsible for a dramatic improvement in Seattle's pass defense when on the field. It's hard for me to give a great grade when you lose a player like that. I think not just on a pure performance level, but just strictly a
process level?
A process level. Like, where you have someone who you want every young player on your roster pretty much to follow Earl Thomas. Maybe not by flipping off Pete Carroll, but in terms of just, you know, the amount of work he puts in, the ability he has, the way he approaches the game, his instincts for the game, you want him teaching that. And I think you want your players to say, hey, if you work really hard, we're going to reward you.
Right.
And I think that's an overstated argument sometimes, but I think if you're not going to reward Earl Thomas, even if you reward Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner, which I'm hoping they do in the season to come with Wagner, I think it does sort of, you can't feel good about that as a player, where you have a guy who suffered multiple injuries, who played hurt, and who was kind of tossed aside. And I think this is someone who, you know, he's a Hall of Famer for me already, I think. I think if he retired tomorrow, I think he would still be a Hall of Famer for me, just because he was so good early in his career.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the number of all-pro picks.
Right. And I think someone who fundamentally changes the way you have to play defense. Like, I think Pete has to change the way he plays He can't play cover three every snap, which he's not. That's overstated. Then Earl Thomas was kind of making fun of that when he made that quote in Baltimore. But, like, Earl Thomas is just a unique athletic specimen and a brilliant player, a incredibly smart player, and someone who I think it's just sad. Like, I remember I was reading about Bill James. I was reading Bill James's abstract when the A's traded Ricky Henderson. And it was just like the whole point of having a baseball team is to get a player like Ricky Henderson. When you have to get rid of him, it sucks. Like, it's just, it's a bummer. So I think the Frank Clark trade, I can see an argument for it, certainly. I can see an argument for not re-signing Earl Thomas, but it's hard for me to give a very good grade when you lose a player of his caliber for... are they going to get a comp pick for Earl Thomas?
They'll get a comp pick.
Okay. Also, they signed Jason Myers to a big deal. Which is bad.
Oh yeah, in process terms, not great.
No, so I find it difficult to believe that Tristan would give a offseason where the Seahawks lost a inner ballot great Seahawk of all time in A+.
It's an aggressive tech.
So it's certainly.
I think he's among that group who is considered a foregone conclusion. So that wasn't an actual grade. What's the grade? No,
I would probably say B-C+.
Okay.
I like the Frank Clark trade. I think it was a good way to move on from a player who I think it might be distasteful to have on the roster to begin with, let alone now.
That's very true.
And certainly a player who I think is very good. I think Frank Clark's a very good player, obviously. But you're not getting a lot of you're not getting a lot of value by signing him to a $20 million
surplus value. Yeah.
You're getting some. I mean, I think he could possibly outplay that, but to get picks for him, I think is a very fair return. I think the picks they got were very valuable. And I think getting that out of Kansas City because they were desperate because they missed out on a couple other options, I think was a great sort of transition for the Seahawks. And I wouldn't have faulted them. I think I would have understood if they had re-signed Clark, but I think they are probably better off having not done it.
Agreed. All right, question three.
Okay, this is the tough one.
It is. Yeah.
Especially, was this your question or Tristan's question?
This is Tristan's question.
Okay.
Rank these quarterbacks for 2019. Jimmy Garoppolo, Jared Goff, Andrew Luck, who has never come up in a question like this before, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan, Matthew Stafford, Russell Wilson.
Okay. I mean, I have a lot of questions about this question. Like, why did he choose these quarterbacks?
Generally similar tier, and then Goff and Garoppolo because of the fact that they're in the NFC West, basically. I mean, Goff also was, like, there was a period where people were talking about him as, like, an MVP candidate or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, would you say Aaron Rodgers and Matthew Stafford are on the same tier?
I don't know. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things I'm interested in because
okay.
Aaron Rodgers' performance the last few years has not been what it was in sure. previous seasons.
Fair.
And we're going to see how much a change in coaching offensive coordinator and okay. play calling philosophy
affects that.
Well, let me ask
you. So that's my follow-up question. So is this a question in terms of who is the best player within the context of the perform or with the system they play in? Is it like if everyone had an average offense with an average coach and an average staff? Is that it? Like what is the...
These are fair questions. Yeah. Let's say the NFL has decided we're redrafting everyone.
Okay, interesting.
And now you're picking among these players.
Okay. I would say Matthew Stafford is last.
Interesting.
I mean, like, would you not put him last?
I think I would probably have Garoppolo last at this
group. Really? Because of health?
I mean, and he wasn't very good last year. He's only had, like, 6 good games in his career.
Okay. I mean, he's only played, like, 8 or 9 games.
No. It's true.
I think the he I was guess
Stafford
bad last
was
year.
Stafford was behind Nick Mullins last year in QBR. I may have forgotten how poor Stafford was last year.
I think the he was bad last year argument is overstated. He played like 3 games. That's not a big enough sample. One of them was against the Vikings, who were very good on defense.
Accurate.
And he was playing in a scheme that is famously difficult to master early on and takes some time to kind of get comfortable in. And he was good. He had some interceptions the previous year, but he was good the previous year.
Yeah.
So I'm still optimistic about Jimmy Garoppolo.
Stafford was 7th in QBR in 2017. So
sure.
A dramatic drop off.
I think he's last.
Okay.
I think Garoppolo is behind him or is ahead of him. I think I would take Jared Goff next. I know there is that idea that he was really always good, and just that first year with Jeff Fisher, he would drag any quarterback down.
I mean, I don't think that part of it is wrong.
Yes. I think that's fair to some extent. I also think that there is certainly an element. I think he is incredible when he is in rhythm, when he just has no pressure, when he is playing against a defense that doesn't really have the ability to stop what the Rams are doing. He misses a fair amount of throws. He is someone who I think, you know, we saw in the Super Bowl. We saw a little bit during the playoffs as well. I think he was better in the Saints game in the second half, obviously. But in the Patriots game, a guy who was not able to, you know, not able to win the game on his own. And I think he could still develop, of course. He still has time. I think he's not – it's unfair to say he is a system quarterback. And I think when I wrote about the idea that he was going – that the Rams could theoretically move on from him and draft a quarterback and trade him for a pick –
what, did not go over well. Yeah, what kind of reaction did that get?
From the Rams?
Yeah.
I don't want to... Let me put it this way. When I did a... Number one, it came up on the Sloan panel.
Right.
Dim off the Rams person. I mentioned it on the Sloan panel. And then I did a...
You haven't made it until you've been trash-talked from the stage.
Yes.
At Sloan.
Yes, it's me and Nate Silver, I think, or... the people who get trash talked the most.
Okay, yeah, the most. I've done it as well. I've been in that group as well.
Really? By who?
Jeff Van Gundy.
Why? I had no idea.
The analytics rankings.
Oh, when was this?
When we put out the analytics rankings right before the Sloan Conference. What was that, 2015?
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
That's awful. Fellow employee, too. That really hurts.
I'm one for two on Van Gundy. Stan shouted out in a positive way something I had written morning of the Sloan Conference.
Right.
So.
I knew that part of it. I didn't realize I had to block Jeff Van Gundy on Twitter now.
but I've got some good and bad news.
Yes. I did a Twitter video with Adam Schefter and Field Yates during the free agency period. And Adam Schefter is famously pretty straight-laced, like a very sort of business-oriented guy, and always been very nice to me. Went on this Twitter video, and the first thing he did was like, relay a message from the Rams to me asking whether I thought they were going to trade Jared Goff or not. And when I think when you're getting like sort of like burned a little bit by Adam Schefter on live Twitter video, I think it's a sign that they took it maybe a little too personally.
Yeah.
The issue's not Jared Goff. I think he's a totally fine quarterback, but I think the issue is when you have, would you rather have Jared Goff at $28 million a year, or would you rather have rather get a top five pick?
Right.
Use that on a quarterback making $8 million a year and then use another $20 million to keep Cooper Kupp and Andrew Whitworth, wherever your left tackle is, as opposed to having Jared Goff at $28 million and then a replacement level slot receiver and a replacement level left tackle.
I would have no idea what a replacement level left tackle would look like.
There were a lot of sub replacement level.
Yeah, that's a good point
for quite a while.
Okay, so we're through three on the list, bottom three.
Yes. I feel like this is the longest answer to a question that has ever possibly appeared on the show. Which is why I warned you about having me on. Matthew Stafford.
Well, maybe that's why I was only allowed three football questions, because otherwise you knew the podcast would take several hours.
Yeah, Matthew Stafford, Jimmy Garoppolo, Jared Goff, and then we have the four remaining are Luck, Rodgers, Ryan Wilson. I would say I'd take Matt Ryan next. Ryan is impressive.
Ben Baldwin is so upset right now.
He's great. I was on the Sark arc last year with Matt Ryan when they were at that red zone streak going.
By the way, did you know that his boat is named Noah Sark?
No.
Yeah, no. 100% accurate.
I find that extremely unlikely.
No, that's incredible. That is straight truth.
That's so good. I like him even more now. And obviously, by the end of the year, it was kind of falling apart. I'm not surprised he was fired, but an offense I think was very underrated, had like the fewest possessions over the past 2 years. Even if he's not the guy, I think he's sort of, there's like an unfair sort of baseline given how good he was in 2016.
Yeah. People think that was like, oh, the entire Shanahan era, which like that, and it didn't.
There were literally people filing petitions to fire Kyle Shanahan after the first year in Atlanta. And I think Matt Ryan is a above average quarterback who I think is very consistently healthy and someone who I think can elevate an offense on his own, which I don't know that Jared Goff can do. So I think Matt Ryan would be better in the Rams offense than Jared Goff would be in the Falcons offense.
Okay.
So I'd say Matt Ryan. Then we have Andrew Luck, Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson. This is tough. This is extremely, extremely tough. I would put Andrew Luck next.
Okay.
I think there is an injury concern with Andrew Luck.
There certainly
obviously
is.
He was great last year. He is a phenomenal football player. A little bit of a propensity to occasionally force throws, which sometimes that works. I think there is a like almost a like robotic calmness, which I like. Like there is like a like his he will like just suddenly like launch like a 70-yard throw and or like a 60-yard throw and
without
will,
warning.
Yeah, without warning, and I'm not expecting it, and it's a perfect throw. And I'm just like, oh yeah, you can do that. I think he's phenomenal. I think he's even now still an underrated quarterback. I just think it's the injury concern. And if I think it's the injury concern, and I'm down to Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers.
Wow.
I might have talked myself into a corner.
Yes.
No. I think I would put Aaron Rodgers ahead of Russell Wilson. But I think I would not blame you for putting Russell Wilson first.
If Rodgers struggles this season, yes. Would you reevaluate him?
Yes, I think I would. I think it's last year was hard. I think it's a very sort of antiquated scheme last year, which people have written about at great length. There was the knee, which is going to limit. I think the first half of the year, the first quarter of the year, he was literally just a one-step drop and throw. The weapons around him are extremely mediocre outside of Devontae Adams, who's very good. I think Jimmy Graham is fine, but was not the player we saw in Seattle the year before. I mean, when you think about weapons, like Russell Wilson does not exactly have a lot to work with and did not have a lot to work with last year and was extremely, extremely, extremely efficient. Does not get hurt. I think he had the one ankle sprain when Ndamukong Suh stepped on his ankle.
Knocking on wood there.
Knocking on wood. Very consistent. Someone who adds value with his legs, which to more of an extent than just about anybody on this list, if I'm not mistaken. Both as a scrambler and as a runner, someone who I think it's fair to say is a, if you value late game performance, clutch performance, I think he certainly belongs in that discussion. Someone who can make all kinds of throws, someone who transcends his system and transcends his scheme. Aaron Rodgers is still the scariest quarterback I've ever seen. So I would put Aaron Rodgers first.
He's terrifying.
And I think one of the more underrated drives in recent NFL history is when when the Seahawks came back in the NFC Championship game, and then Aaron Rodgers with the loudest stadium in the league against a top five defense
and all the momentum on the other
side. All the momentum.
Oh, so much momentum.
Drove down the field and got them into overtime.
Only to never touch the football again.
Only to never touch the football.
Who scored that touchdown?
I don't remember. But I think it was someone who had a very bad passer rating with Russell Wilson, so he was excommunicated from the team.
That's another tweet I came across when I was looking through our old tweets.
And true fans decided he was no longer a valuable part of the franchise.
You know who you were replying to about that stat?
I do.
It was Mina?
It was Mina Kimes. Somewhat
an enemy of the Curse Crew?
An enemy of the Curse Crew.
Friend of the Kaysen Crew.
Friend of the Kaysen Crew. Part of the... one of the Young Popes...
Yes.
I think it's fair to say. I think Jermaine Curse is obviously a very underrated part of this last decade.
There we go. I'm clipping that. That's going in the best of the Pelton cast when we do the 200th episode.
Go for it.
Jermaine Curse is underrated.
I'm happy to stand by that. I think if Aaron Rodgers struggles this year with David LaFleur, I think it would be the point where I'd start lowering my expectations for what his ceiling is. Whereas I still think his ceiling is the absolute best quarterback in football history.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's it. Football questions. All done.
Was that as bad as you feared?
Yes. I had to rank quarterbacks.
I know. I made you answer the question. I know I would hate to answer myself, but
that's
great.
Like a very like, you know, morning radio show question, but yeah. At least I was given the list of quarterbacks 90 seconds before we started to record the show. So I had plenty of time to prep.
It was at least 5 minutes.
At least 5 minutes. Yes. But yeah, I mean, I think it depends on if you're evaluating it in a vacuum versus evaluating it in the scheme that the quarterback is playing in. I think it's totally different. I think the Niners are going to make the playoffs this year, so I would be much higher on Jimmy Garoppolo.
Oh, that is a mildly hot take.
It is, but I think...
You've hit the medium at Hattie B's with that take.
I did, yes.
That should be the new...
If I did...
Take spiciness a little.
I did, as I was doing my podcast with Robert Mays last week, I had Sam Darnold to win MVP at, I think, 75-1. That's more of a...
That's
a Prince's. medium to hot take.
That's a 24-hour experience, that take.
Well, yes, exactly. Well, I mean,
on Twitter, it's maybe longer than that.
Yes, you could see the argument for why the Niners would make the playoffs.
Yes.
They were a team that had their starting quarterback for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks last year. They were a team that grossly underperformed their Pythagorean expectation. They were a team that added two stars at their biggest position of weakness at the pass rush last year, where they drafted Nick Bosa. They signed Dee Ford. They've invested a bunch in free agency. They have a very talented cornerback by the name of Richard Sherman. They have a very good offensive line. They have a good defensive line now. There is a lot of similarities to last year's Colts for me.
Interesting.
Where a team that did not have their quarterback the year before, and you know, their backup quarterback played fine, but I think having the guy helped. And I don't think Jimmy Garoppolo is going to have an Andrew Luck caliber year, and I think he's still going to struggle to stay healthy, but my expectation is that he'll play 13 games as opposed to 3. And if that happens, I think they will be in good enough shape to make the playoffs. I do think...
Also, Nick Mullins will be playing those 3 games as opposed to... I can't even remember.
CJ Beathard.
Yeah, that was not great.
Theoretically. But I don't know that... I think the Rams are going to decline a bit.
Yeah.
In 2019.
And some regression to the mean, yes, too, there.
And I don't think I should comment on how I feel about the Seahawks on this podcast.
I think we got a taste of it earlier.
I mean, like, I think they'll be fine.
No, I don't... Yeah, I mean, I think my expectations are, like, you know...
Should we
leave 7-9 to 8-8?
I would say between 7-9 and 9-7.
Yeah.
Should we leave a space here for Tristan's
reply
for the Seahawks?
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be that optimistic. I think he just really likes... He's... Most people are so obsessed with the current, you know, like, what's happening now that mm-hmm. he probably tends to overweight future value.
Okay.
I think that's the big discrepancy.
So there. He's projecting a 15-1 season 3 years from now.
Yes.
When all these comp picks are peaking. I mean, like, you know, if they went 10-6, it wouldn't be the most shocking thing in the history of the universe. But, I mean, I think if the Niners are better, the Cardinals should theoretically be better. They might be. Actually, no. We don't know.
You're saying better than they were last season, yes. Not better than the Seahawks.
Right. Not better than the Seahawks. Better than they were a year ago.
I would hope so.
Yes.
If not, there's something seriously wrong in Arizona.
Yes. I don't know. I mean, they hired the weirdest hire.
It's one of the most remarkable examples of failing up in coaching history.
You know what? As someone who needs to fail up to get any higher than he is right now, that sounds great. It sounds lovely. If I could just get fired from ESPN and then suddenly be running a team somehow, that sounds fantastic.
Well, speak it into existence. On that note, thanks so much for finally joining us.
It's my pleasure. How many years has the Belden Cast been going on for?
Well, there was a hiatus.
There was a hiatus.
We're coming up on 3 years since it's been back.
How long included the hiatus?
Like, how long has it actually existed as a podcast? Yeah. We're coming up on 6 years.
Okay, so once every 6 years.
Oh, it's like cicadas?
Yes, I will say that. It's like cicadas because it floods you and then you want to run away. But also, I will say the next time the U.S. national team wins the World Cup.
All right, that's fair.
I will hop on the show. I'm also willing to consider a one-to-one Sue Bird, Bill Barnwell appearance level. Where for once every time Sue Bird appears in the podcast, I'm also willing to appear on the podcast to keep up.
I'm going to have to talk to Sue about that then.
That's very fair.
Thanks for doing this.
It's my pleasure.